Oh, from what I see now, that'll cut through the murkiest storm they can dish up. What I'm trying to say is, Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight?
It will be an honor, sir.
Oh, you don't believe that, do you?
You see, my mother's Mrs. Walker, the lady who hired you. But I must say, you're the best looking one I've ever seen.
Really?
Your beard doesn't have one of those things that goes over your ears.
Well, that's because it's real. Just like I'm really Santa Claus.
It's Christmas Eve. It's the one night of the year when we all act a little nicer. We smile a little easier. We share a little more. For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be.
Everything I do turns into a disaster. I guess I really don't know what Christmas is all about. Isn't there anyone who knows what Christmas is all about?
Sure, Charlie Brown. I can tell you what Christmas is all about. Lights, please.
And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night, and lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them. And the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God, and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
Hey everyone, this is the Think About Now podcast. Today, once again, we have Professor Joe Rogers on the show. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing good. How are you, Carlos?
Fantastic. So,
Today
we're going to do an odd seasonal holiday-related episode.
Yeah, it seems appropriate.
Yeah, you know, it's really the reason for the season, and I'm not talking about Kwanzaa, because Christmas is obviously coming up, right? The Son of God's B-Day celebration, commemorated, of course, by a giant man whose colors resemble the, you know, Adamita muscaria hallucinogenic mushroom, who stops time and space to shuttle around the convertible rock on a sleigh powered by magical, talking, inebriated Icelandic reindeer, flying in and out of chimneys, apartment air vents, and basement stone walls. And, of course, he delivers gifts to children. Gifts which closely resemble the types of goods which are easily affordable to the socioeconomic demographic. It's amazing how that works.
It's all a mystery. That's all you need to know. It's a mystery.
but that's not all, of course. You, of course, have non-Arabic trees adorned with artificial lights, songs praising the magic of a pagan holiday, and, you know, 60 days of primo sales at every major corporation. And those are, of course, the bedrock of this beautiful day to come. But I don't imagine that was the purpose or the beginnings of the celebration, right, Joe?
No, definitely not. Yeah, it's got a very, very long, long, and I would say tortured history as well.
Okay, so tell me about the first Christmas celebration, and was Walmart and Coca-Cola involved?
Definitely not. In fact, I would say that even in the early, at least among the Christians, well, I guess you need to start when you're saying Christmas. How would you define it? What are you defining Christmas as?
You know, that's funny. I've been dabbling around trying to check out a lot of different historical accounts of when Christmas kind of started. But in my mind, it's people coming around to possibly exchange goods or just have a familial celebration in commemoration of Christ.
Okay, so if you're discussing Christmas in terms of like the birth of Jesus, the early Christian church really didn't give a whole lot of emphasis to that, only because in the ancient world, of course, like birthdays weren't a thing. You know what I mean? In the early church, in fact, one of the earliest Christmas celebrations as a liturgy, as a like a religious feast or a religious holiday, probably didn't show up until the 3rd or 4th century. So Christians, for the first 400 years of their existence, didn't even celebrate this holiday.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, because it wasn't, again, like for them, for the early Christians, Easter, you know, the resurrection, that was the big, that was the thing they celebrated. The birth was just kind of a side note. It really wasn't a, that big of a deal.
But they did have, at least early Christian centuries, if you will, they had winter festivals, right? That
centered around winter solstice? The world in which they lived in did. So, like, you know, the pagans celebrated solstice festivals, of course. And as the Christian world began to grow, they began to adopt many of these practices. So that by the time you move into what's classically called Christendom, where, you know, Europe, Western Europe is now officially Christian, they essentially, Christianity adopts many of these pagan images, pagan celebrations, and sort of, and I'm using my little air quotes here, and sort of baptize those holidays so that they take on a Christian flavor. But the sort of remnants of that, of those pagan holidays exist with us down through the centuries, even today, which, you know, get in your car and drive around any suburban neighborhood and you'll see traces of it.
And you were mentioning that they kind of allowed, they just developed a religious connotation regarding these celebrations. So when did, you know, the idea of December 25th as being this important day kind of get involved? Because I know the Bible never mentions December 25th.
No, there's no, and even in Christianity, there was even a divide between the Christians who lived in the West and the Christians who lived in the East. So Christians at this point in the, you know, in the first 400 or 500 years of the church, they weren't unified. They weren't, in other words, there wasn't like a strong structure. And so you had Christians who would celebrate certain holidays one way in one part of the world, and Christians who would celebrate the same holiday differently in another part. So for instance, the Feast of the Epiphany. I don't know if you're familiar with Epiphany, which happens on January 6th. That in the East, that for them was their celebration of the story of Jesus's birth. The December 25th date that you and I in the West are more familiar with, we're not really sure exactly where in history, like why that particular date. A lot of theories surround the idea of the Roman pagan holidays on the solstice kind of falling around that time. And so a lot of people speculate that it was more than likely the Christians adopted December 25th as a celebration of Jesus's, of the nativity, Jesus's birth, as sort of a co-opting of the pagan holidays that were celebrated at the same time.
Yeah, co-opting, though, that term to me a lot of times has derogatory aspect to it a lot of times.
Yeah, and I don't mean it derogatory. I think it just happens. It just happens. You know what I mean? It's like anything else. When you're seeped in a culture, you begin to take on some of that culture as well. And certainly for the Christians, as they're going about into the world and gathering more converts, by sword or by inviting people to the religion, they're going to want to make it as appealing as possible. And if you and I are pagans in the ancient world, and we have this awesome celebration that we celebrate, and here comes this group that wants us to either join, that invites us to join them, or is forcing us to join them in order to call ourselves, you know, members of the Roman Empire, we're still going to want to retain some of our old ways of doing things. And so the Christian rulers were fairly smart, I think, in allowing the pagans to retain some of their traditions that they were most familiar with as they embraced this new religion.
Absolutely. And you still, of course, find that today. I mean, even the Catholic Church, you know, the cool socialist hippie Pope right now, who's kind of allowing all these different types of people within the church now, as he's seeing it change. I mean, John Paul II did this too, especially when you talk about all you really needed to do was accept Jesus Christ in order to be a Christian. You didn't have to do a lot of the other rituals to be part of that, which allowed, you know, the Spanish to be able to keep their many, many, many gods, to become even more of an expansionist polytheistic religion that you see in a lot of middle and southern Mexico, you know, where they add all these different types of gods.
Yeah.
And what I was finding interesting regarding the Christmas thing, though, is how some of the customs, of course, and those festivals, not only were they corresponding at the same time, but a lot of the festivities were very similar, right? So you have the Roman Saturnalia, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's held from December 17th and then expanded all the way to the 23rd.
Right.
And it was about celebrating this sacrifice. And it was a sacrifice of the Temple of Saturn in the Roman Forum and a public banquet followed by private gift giving, continual partying, and carnival atmosphere that overturned, and this is the most interesting part to me, Roman social norms. So this is where the Puritans probably wouldn't like it. Gambling was permitted.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you think of more of our modern celebrations of Mardi Gras, you know, especially down in the French Quarter where it's, you know, just a free for all, that I think that you're probably getting more into what probably some of these pagan celebrations were like. And certainly Christmas, as we start moving through the centuries, became more and more like that. You know what I mean? It became this sort of like an anything goes festival, so that when we then let's kind of jump ahead in history to the colonies, the American colonies, Christmas was actually outlawed in the colonies by the Puritans because it was at that point such a crazy, you know, party atmosphere that they basically banned Christmas. That's why it cracks me up when, you know, I won't mention the channel, but when you hear like on a particular channel at this time of year, the war on Christmas, when it's ironic, when in the early days of the founding of the United States, Christmas was actually not allowed to be celebrated by the very Christians who kind of had such a hand in the forming of this of the founding of the United States.
Well, if we wanted to play the game of whenever you're outraged, how many of your forefathers did those exact same actions, we'd be here all day.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, for sure.
And I'm actually going to hit on the war on Christmas thing just for one second, because it's pretty interesting. Because under the state atheism of the Soviet Union, there was a war on Christmas. And it's interesting. After its foundation, it was called state atheism, right? And its foundation was started in 1917, right? And Christmas celebrations, along with other Christmas holidays, were prohibited publicly. So during the 20s, 30s, and 40s, I fucking love this name, the League of Militant Atheists encouraged school pupils to campaign against Christmas traditions, such as Christmas trees, as well as other Christian holidays, including Easter. The League also established an anti-religious holiday to be the 31st of each month as a replacement. At the height of the persecution in 1929 on Christmas Day, children in Moscow were encouraged to spit on crucifixes as a protest against the holiday.
Wow.
Which just sounds like, you know, your modern, like, I don't know, anthropology department at a liberal arts school, really. I mean, that's just your normal gathering. And it wasn't until the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991 the persecution ended, and now the Orthodox Christians are all about Christmas. I mean, it's a full-on celebration. It's a bit like, you know, post-prohibition. But I wanted to kind of get back because there were a few more things that I found that were pretty interesting that got kind of transferred over. One of them was the greenery, lights, and charity came from the Roman New Year celebration.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have that correspondence there. And then the Yule logs and various foods came from the Germanic feasts.
Yeah.
But then you get into this weird spot, right, where are you trying to search for specific similarities that might not be really be there? And a big one for me is whenever people decide to bring up Egyptians, because I'm like, you know, a lot of these people didn't hang out with
with one another, right?
Right, of course.
So the Egyptian deity Horus, son to goddess Isis, was celebrated at the winter solstice. And Horus was often depicted being fed by his mother, which also influenced the symbolism of the Virgin Mary with baby Christ. I wanted to know if that was actually a valid statement.
I'm uncomfortable making that connection only because, I mean, it's mother and child. Like, you can't get much more basic than that. I mean, it's a mother and child. Like, every culture can resonate with that image. So, you know, you see in Japan an image of a mother and child, and you want to rush to say, oh my God, these people had contact with the ancient Egyptians. Well, no, it's a mother and child. You know what I mean? So I'm not comfortable making that close a connection.
It's also the virgin birth thing. Whenever people bring that up, are like, well, this also came with a birth of random circumstances. I'm like, yeah, because that's why they're special. Like, what do you really know of life? People come out of vaginas. There may be some connection with paternity. We actually don't really have a very good idea of how that works. You eat, then you die. So something important has to happen between there to write a story about.
Yeah. I mean, in the whole, like, even I think sometimes the whole, I think it's overemphasized even by Christians themselves, the whole virgin birth. Only because, I mean, if you look at, say, for instance, in Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, and behold, a virgin shall bear a child, the virgin that they're talking about literally just means young woman. It doesn't mean biologically intact. Does that make sense? In other words, it doesn't mean a woman who's not who's somehow magically reproduced.
And that's
it. It just means young woman, virgin, like think medieval virgin, like young girls. That's all it means. It's a girl of, you know, childbearing age who it doesn't mean by supernatural means, getting pregnant by supernatural means.
And that's something I've heard hippies and academics state a lot, that it really didn't mean virgin at the time. So I just wanted to make sure I clarified. And
hold on. Before you get, let me clarify.
Please.
I would say that is absolutely true for the Old Testament, for those, especially those particular passages from Isaiah. However, when we look at the New Testament, even though they make reference to the Old Testament, they're clearly trying to say that Jesus came about into the world by special means. You know what I mean? I'm trying to say that it's much more heavily emphasized. The supernatural element is more heavily emphasized about Jesus's conception than certainly Isaiah is talking about. So I don't want to conflate the two. I don't want to say they're both saying the exact same thing, because they're not.
Okay. And then this gets me into a side question here. How much is the Jesus story an embodiment or reflection of the story within the Old Testament, as in this is supposed to be the chosen prophet here?
It depends on which one you're looking at. So clearly in Matthew's gospel, he makes those connections over and over again because his audience is a Jewish audience. So he wants his audience to really dig the Jesus story. So he's constantly making references to the Old Testament. He constantly has Jesus throughout the Gospel of Matthew quote passages from the Old Testament just to kind of show that Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecies in the Old Testament, less so in John, less so in Luke.
Okay. And as far as to get rid of the old law, but to fulfill it, was that Matthew?
Yes.
Okay. Just double checking there. My biblical history is a little bit off. I haven't been yelling at Christians anytime recently, so I haven't had to look anything up in a hot minute.
Dust it off a little bit.
Yeah, I'm a little bit dusty here. Okay, then let's talk a little bit more then about what the Bible as a whole even talked about the birth process. I mean, what is the idea here? Where was he actually born? Because you hear kind of contradicting statement, and as we brought up last episode, even the birth story is different in two different books.
Yeah, that's right. So like the Christmas story, as we call it, is, like I said at the start of the podcast, like birthdays in the ancient world were not a big deal. People weren't at all concerned. They you know, even the Gospels themselves, they want to get right to the heart of the matter, which is the story of Jesus' ministry. They're really not interested in all of his, you know, background details. However, as, you know, as the Christian documents start getting edited, of course, the natural questions are, you know, what about his origins? And so when you look at the origin stories in Matthew and Luke, I would say that even there, they're not pointing towards the historical birth of Jesus so much as they are trying to talk about who Jesus is. In fact, it's often been said that the Christmas story in Matthew and Luke, if you just took those stories by themselves, just the Christmas story, you would have the entire gospel kind of in miniature. So they're really, it's kind of a literary device to point towards something that's going to happen later in the Gospels.
Okay, that certainly makes sense. And
so can I give you an example?
Yeah, go
so
for it.
For example, in the Gospel of Matthew, and only in the Gospel of Matthew, you get the story of the wise men coming to pay homage to the infant Jesus. Today we call them the three kings. There's no mentions of kings. There's even no mention of how many there are. There could have been 10, there could have been 2, there could have been 20. It just says wise men from the east coming, and what they bring are gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And those are all the gospel, those are all Matthew's way of trying to say that Jesus is the Messiah who will die, be buried, and rise again. Because, you know, especially frankincense and myrrh, were traditional ways in which people anointed bodies before they were to be buried. So an ancient audience, while they're reading this, or hearing this more likely, hearing this story, they immediately are being tipped off as a literary genre of what's going to come at the end of the story. It's kind of like if all of a sudden at the start of the story, we start hearing about embalming fluids and, you know, burial rituals, it's giving us a hint of how the story is going to end.
That's really fascinating. That foreshadowing there, that most
that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a wonderful foreshadow there. And it's interesting because it is the visit of the Magi, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And from what I was able to look into, it was in the early Middle Ages that was more what was celebrated.
Yeah, well, certainly by the time you get, like I said, as I said at the start, you know, how Christians in the East celebrated differently than Christians in the West. And we still have remnants of that today. So that when you look at, say, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, their celebration of Christmas to this day is January 6th. Which is the Feast of the Epiphany. And so all their gift giving is done not by Santa Claus, but by the three wise men. In fact, you can even see, I think in Mexico and Puerto Rico and certain Latin American countries, the Feast of the Epiphany is still a big deal. Like, you know, you leave out, I guess, hay for the much in the way that kids today would leave out cookies for Santa Claus, you leave out hay for the wise men's camels and they leave you gifts. So there's still those traditions that go on.
Yeah, my family actually celebrated that.
Three
Kings Day. Puerto Ricans? I don't know. They did Three Kings Day, so it was great. So
did you do Santa Claus too?
Yeah, we did both. So it'd be Christmas Day, and then I think it was like 2 days later or something, we did Three Kings Day, okay. And we'd have to lay out hay and do this whole little thingy, and then we'd get like the dollar store gifts for that day.
They just
burned the whole budget. And it was really important to my mom when I was growing up. I remember this random conversation with her saying like that is it was a very important celebration for her and her family.
Interesting.
Like, yeah, I don't exactly know where that comes from or if a lot of Puerto Ricans do that as well. Honestly, I haven't researched it enough. This is the first thought I've had of it in a while, but it was kind of a big deal, and all my white friends were confused, you know. But they weren't like jealous of the presents because, again, it was like, you know, the dollar store action figure. It's like, yeah, Three Kings Day. Awesome.
Oh my God, that's awesome. Yeah, but in Eastern Orthodox Christianity, they don't celebrate Christmas on the 25th. So their big day still to this day is January 6th. And that comes from, you know, this idea of gift giving from the wise men.
That's fascinating. And so let's talk a bit about how this started coming up. So we're talking about kind of early Christians. There's a building there of a movement or a discussion regarding the celebration. But I mean, certainly the idea of Christmas that we have now is not the Christmas even of 50 years ago.
No, that's right.
Yeah. So when is this kind of transfer occurring? I mean, even Christmas trees, those aren't that recent. I mean, those have still been around for quite a while. I mean, because what was it? And this is actually I was reading a fascinating book on this. It was the use of evergreen trees, wreaths, yes, and garlands to mm-hmm. symbolize eternal life was a custom That's of the right. ancient Egyptians, Chinese, and Hebrews, which is interesting to find something of all three.
Well, I mean, it, if you think of most like primitive, and I don't mean this in any way pejoratively, so what I'm about to say, don't take it as a pejorative, but if you think of any sort of primitive peoples, they have this belief, especially if they're tied somehow to paganism, this idea that all of life is infused with spirits, right? So here's this tree that remains evergreen throughout the year. And so it must be in that line of thinking. It must be infused with good spirits. So what better way to have your home be filled with these good spirits than on certain festivals and certain feast days to bring in an evergreen into your home so that as you bring the evergreen into your home, the spirits come with these evergreens and kind of hang out in your house and bring you good luck and bring you all sorts of good things.
Yeah, and they were also used in Scandinavian customs as well. But what yeah. was interesting is they would add decorations, and I guess the suggestion that's been made was that you would hold them up until the new year to scare away the devil, and setting up a tree of birds during the actual Christmas time.
Oh, interesting. I'd not heard that.
Yeah, so the modern Christmas tree is frequently traced to the symbolism of trees in pre-Christian winter rites, wherein yep. Viking and Saxon worship trees, right?
That would not surprise me at all.
Yeah, and just one more here, because I just found all these fun little snippets here. The story of Saint Boniface cutting down Donner's oak illustrates the pagan practices in 8th century among the Germans, right?
Oh my God. So,
and a later folk version of the story adds a detail that an evergreen tree grew in place of the felled oak,
yes.
telling them about how its triangular shape reminds humanity, this is such a fucking stretch, of the Trinity and how it points to heaven.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing more than I love than an overly stretched metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you really find it. I mean, we'll do this whenever Easter comes around, if you're still up for this, but I would love to do the stretch of the fucking Easter Bunny as not yeah. being a fertility holiday. I'm just like,
yeah,
I know.
It's... Yeah, even I've read even recently, like, you know, the and it's absolutely not true, but I've seen it circulating on social media, and it always comes up this time of year, the famous the 12 Days of Christmas song. Christians will often say that really that song was meant as a way to teach, kind of covertly teach people Christianity, because on the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a partridge in a pear tree is symbolic of the one true God, monotheism. And then they go through all the 12 days of Christmas trying to suggest that it was written as a song to teach people about Christianity, which is absolutely not true. And I think it goes to exactly what you're saying, is this stretching of the metaphor. And because I think what happens, I think naturally, is when you've got a really cool holiday like Christmas, and there's so many cool things involved in it, but it's kind of a mix match of a bunch of different things, with everybody kind of throwing their ingredient into the pot, someone's going to want to come along and take kind of ownership of it, you know, say, oh, well, this is really my contribution to the pot, when really it's not. So I'm a little hesitant to these, as you said, these stretched metaphors.
You ever watch Christian Magic before?
Magic shows? Is that a thing?
They had it at UTSA. University of Texas, San Antonio, by the way, folks. There's no reason I should assume anyone knows what that acronym is. Crusaders for Christ brought on Christian magicians. It's totally a thing. You need to look it up. It's the best thing that's ever happened. But it'll be like, as I have this beautiful cup of water, representing innocence. And then I add blackness. Bam.
No.
Put a little thing of water in there. And that represents sin. But through the power of Jesus Christ, bam. And he puts it, I think it's potassium something, and it basically turns the water clear again.
That's awful.
And now all sin has been forgiven. But of course, if the guy actually drinks it, he's going to get fucking poisoned. These are harmful chemicals.
I wonder what that would symbolize. Oh, God.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
awful.
No. In fundamentalist Christianity, there's this whole stretch of Christian magic, because, as you well know, in a lot of Christian churches, especially fundamentalists, you can't even dance. Never mind, do devil magic, because they believe that stuff is real. Right. So,
yeah, but it kind of goes, I think that's a great example that you used, even though I'd never heard of Christian magic before. It kind of goes to the point we're making, that like any religious group, here we're talking specifically about Christians, they look around at the culture that they're in, they see some sort of thing that's working, magic, rock music, country music, you name it, and then they co-opt it. So it becomes Christian rock. It becomes Christian, country Christian music, Christian magic shows that I didn't know were a thing. So you know what I mean? So it makes perfect sense then that here the Christians come and there's this great pagan celebration, but now they're Christian. The country's Christian now. It's not pagan. So let's just do the next best thing, and let's keep a little of this and keep a little of that and call it this and call it that. Boom. Now you've got Christmas.
Oh, I mean, yeah. And some of the stretches, I'm going to bring up a few more of these just so you can have fun. Okay, there was another thing here which had to do with candles being added to the evergreen tree. Apparently the 16th century origins is the fact that Martin Luther was the first person who thought of that.
Oh,
how about
okay.
that? Doesn't that reconcile? Yeah. And I can, I'll show the sources for all this crazy stuff in a second here. Regarding the tree as well, it is identified with the Tree of Paradise or medieval mystery plays that were given on the 24th of December, the commemoration and name day of Adam and Eve in various countries. In such plays, a tree decorated with apples to represent the forbidden fruit and wafers to represent the Eucharist and redemption was used as a setting for the play. Like the Christmas crib, the paradise tree was later placed in homes. And the apples, and I don't know, that's the thing, it's like a lot of this is, you're just guessing. The apples were replaced by round objects such as shiny red balls later on. Again, seems like a stretch for me.
It does, it seems like a stretch for me too. I mean, yeah, I'm not really sure. I think it's a bit of a stretch. I mean, but like I said, there is no doubt that Christians obviously wanted to find some sort of Christian meaning in this, because they wanted to continue to celebrate this thing that they really liked to do. You know what I mean? Same thing. And eventually, even here in the United States, in the colonies, the Puritans, didn't end up getting their way. I mean, they lost in the end, the Puritans, because Christmas is going strong to this day.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about that, actually. What was the Puritan war on Christmas?
Well, because it was exactly as we were talking. It really, at that time, was an excuse to get drunk and to have a really good time and have a big party. And the Puritans just weren't up for that. That was for those papists, that was for those Catholics across the pond who were pagan and idolaters, and they hated anything that smacked of Catholicism. And here these Catholics were across the sea in Europe, and they were getting drunk on Christmas Day, and they were having parties on Christmas Day, and the Puritans wanted to let it be known that in this new land that's not the way things were going to be.
Absolutely. I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, Puritans honestly tried to ruin everything.
Oh, absolutely.
Time.
Yeah, all the time.
It was their thing.
Yeah, no, it'd be awful. Like, I mean, the most dour, unhappy people.
Absolutely. And let's get into a little bit more here. So you did mention when we were talking, there's some darker history to the celebration. Were there certain events that occurred that kind of, I don't know. Everyone wants to know what the seedy underbelly of everything is, right?
The seedy underbelly of Christmas?
Yeah, let's do it. Come on. Give me something good.
Seedy underbelly of Christmas. I'm trying to think. You're going to have to help me out. I'm trying to think what we were talking about last time.
No, this is fantastic. I'm glad to know that there's not. You see, because the thing is that the thing that a lot of people who are kind of the commie persuasion, who don't realize it, are quite puritanical, especially whenever they talk about the topic of Christmas, right? I'm secular, right? I'm not.
Right.
I do not worship a god as of right now.
Right.
I haven't for quite some time. Right. But I don't mind the celebration. What I do mind is some of the aspects that kind of bother me are pressure to give gifts.
Right.
You know, maybe that's not the worst possible thing, but in certain cases, you're supposed to undermine all of your viewpoints for the sake of a family dinner that is incredibly uncomfortable, right? And that's what we hear about, you know, Uncle Joey getting too drunk and then yelling at someone.
Yeah.
Or, you know, don't bring up the fact that you're gay at the dinner table because grandma, you know, whatever is going to be there.
Would have a heart attack.
Yeah, it's going to have a heart attack. And then there's the other aspect, which is rather unfortunate. And, you know, I've been in sales. I've been in writing. I've played around in a lot of different types of industries for a guy who's only 29. But, of course, what I found repeatedly is what is one of the best ways to kind of sell someone on anything? Wouldn't you love that before Christmas? Like, wouldn't you love a new laminate flooring or a new house or this new bed set or pans or things like that? And it's rather unfortunate that people end up going into debt for these things. But that's
and you know what, though? Yeah. I would say that all those things that you're talking about, I would say that falls squarely on the shoulders of secular Christmas. Does that make sense? In other words, like one of the things that like, I guess you could say if Christians bitch and complain, you know, Jesus is the reason for the season. You know, you've heard all these like these stupid little taglines that they say. But it's in other words, I would argue that they would probably, if you had one of them on your show, they would probably say that they would think that all this emphasis on gifts and family discord and, you know, Uncle Joey getting drunk, that those are not what Christmas is all about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense? So I think that falls this idea on, oh my God, we're all going to be in debt because of Christmas. I would say that falls on a secular celebration of Christmas rather than a religious celebration of Christmas.
Yeah, because you start to separate the kind of family gathering aspect almost with more the gift giving, especially when it's like, oh, I got to give a gift for all of these different random people, you know, some random piece of crap. But it shows that you care about someone. And I can understand, because what you're doing is time is money. And I understand that on a deeper philosophical way than I think a lot of other people do. It's like, how much is your mortality worth for you?
Right.
So it's an expression of, well, I spent this 3 hours all for you by giving you this gift, right? Because it literally took that amount of labor, so it's kind of demonstrating that. Charles Dickens, it was interesting adding an aspect of this a lot of people don't realize, because they think, oh, well, he was just kind of writing about how Christmas was. But he kind of transformed what Christmas is as we know it.
Right. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. Again, he would, if you look at like Victorian England, again, this is, you know, the Victorians were who they were. I mean, they were kind of, you know, holdovers from the Puritans who kind of stayed behind. Right. Like he was trying to show a different side of Christmas as opposed to the carousing and the drunkenness and the, you know, the partying. He was trying to show what the quote unquote true spirit of Christmas was.
Yeah. And he, this was a lot of interesting writings on how he kind of changed things, because essentially he sought to construct Christmas as a family-centered festival of generosity, right, linking worship and feasting within a context of a kind of social reconciliation.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So he superimposed his kind of humanitarian vision of the holiday.
Yeah.
And that ended up getting coined, I thought it was interesting, as the Carol philosophy.
As the what?
It was called Carol philosophy, C-A-R-O-L.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there was a whole thing about it. So he ended up influencing many aspects of Christmas that are celebrated in what is now Western culture, such as the family gathering aspects, seasonal yeah. food and drink, dance and games, and a festive generosity of spirit.
Yeah.
And a really interesting one was that Merry Christmas wasn't really popularized that much until he kind of popularized it in his book.
Oh, that's bad. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. And it coincided with the appearance of the Oxford movement and the growth of Anglo-Catholicism, which led to a revival in traditional rituals and religious observances. So it was interesting how those things kind of played together to get to where we are right now.
Yeah, I think because I've probably read that novel probably 15 to 20 times because I'm a big fan of Dickens. And what I find interesting about A Christmas Carol is how much it resonates, I think, with this idea of sort of a humanitarian philosophy. Because I think one of the things that we've done today from Dickens to today is we sort of dumbed his work down so that Scrooge becomes any sort of, if you look at any sort of like lame TV special that sort of borrows Dickens, A Christmas Carol, it's always focused on a man who is mean becoming a nice man. And that's not what Dickens was trying to do. If you really read that story, it's just marvelous. His use of language is phenomenal. He talks about Scrooge's conversion is not from going from being a mean person to a nice person. It's he gets to realize that everybody is on the same boat towards death, where it's basically, in fact, I think the actual words he says is, we're all fellow travelers to the grave. And so that he comes to see that he himself, as opposed to the poorest person, you know, who, you know, is on the street, that they're all equals, that they're all people who are someday going to die. And so that we get one shot at this to try and make our lives a little more tolerable with each other. And that's it. And I think that's the key to understanding A Christmas Carol from Dickens. It's not mean people being nice. It's just recognizing that we're all in this boat together and we're all going to die someday. And I think it's phenomenal. But I did not know that about that what you had said about how much he transformed Christmas.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And I don't think it's too shocking that the message regarding Scrooge did get slightly subverted or changed as time went by, because a reminder of mortality, right, is something that a lot of people try to run away from on a constant basis.
Right.
Instead, it's just, oh, he just became good.
Yeah, no.
Right. It's not because we're going to die one day.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Which I try to reemphasize on the show a lot. I'd mean it in the nicest way, but it's like, hey, right. we got one shot. We might as well be, you know, groovy to each other as much as we possibly can.
Yeah, pretty much.
And I do find that interesting, but let's get to one other aspect here, which is the invisible but red-coated man in the room, Santa.
Yeah.
Where the hell does he come from?
Well, St. Nicholas, of course, was a historical person. He was a bishop in Turkey. And I think a lot of, like, you know, again, before colonization, so Middle Ages, the feast of St. Nicholas is still to this day December 6th. So the feast of St. Nicholas, again, these stories of early saints who lived in the early church period, a lot of their stories are mythologized. So a lot of it is not based in history. So there's a lot of stories, you know, legends around these figures. And so supposedly St. Nicholas was this bishop who was constantly good to the poor, and he would often, you know, leave gifts for the poor. And so the theory goes that on the feast of St. Nicholas, this is when you gave gifts to people who were, you know, struggling financially or who were in need. And so you would surprise them with the little gifts. And so that's, I think that is, has some of the, so when a lot of the immigrants started coming to the New World to bringing their kind of holiday celebrations, St. Nicholas came with them. And then, you know, the whole image of like Santa Claus, the, you know, the red hat and the boots, that got a lot of that got formalized, of course, by the Coca-Cola company. Before that, it was what was it? I'm going to mess his name up. I think it's Samuel Clemens, the famous poem, "The Night Before Christmas," when all through the house not a creature was stirring. That famous poem. He really sort of transformed it as well to make Santa Claus into sort of a jolly old elf. So you can kind of see it, you know, connect the dots. You've got this early saint who was a bishop connected to, you know, this celebration of giving children gifts, connected to this, you know, in the poem of this elf, to all the way down to Coca-Cola and red hats and, you know, big boots and buckles and ho ho ho, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So what you're really telling me is that Santa Claus is a refugee conspiracy to tear apart the true sanctity of Jesus Christ and take down Western civilization?
No, I'm definitely not saying that.
What?
Not
really?
At all. Sure? No, I'm pretty sure I'm not saying that. I'm saying
Make America Great Again is about, you know, kicking out Santa Claus but saying Merry Christmas.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, God.
By the way, is he going to make good on that promise, by the way? Is he going to, like, kick the shit out of every single person who doesn't say,
oh, God,
Merry Christmas? Do you remember? That was one of his fucking campaign promises.
I did not know that. You're just bullshitting me.
No, I am not. That is too ridiculous for me to make up. I do not have the imagination to come up with the things that comes out of that man's mouth. Living proof that when a man runs for president, all you have to say is, if I was genie, I would do this.
Oh, God.
It's genie stuff, but let's get out of that. But it's just too good. Like,
he
made that promise.
That's ridiculous.
It's very, very odd. But anyway, getting back to this idea of the Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
So at some point with any zeitgeist, with any major character, mm-hmm. In order to sell the idea, you have to sterilize it, and you have to make it into a succinct character so it's easily marketable.
Yes. Right?
That
makes sense.
That trademark or copyright, like you have to have a name there.
Yeah.
And so there's conspiracy theorists on every side, and then on the leftist side, it's, you know, everything bad about Christmas is because of capitalists. I disagree, but they will state that, oh, well, the modern Santa didn't even exist until Coca-Cola. Well, it did.
Well, of course,
it was canonized.
Right. Absolutely. And it's like, so for instance, if you were to get any 10-year-old child and you were to take him to one of those places in any shopping mall at this time of year that sells like Christmas decoration, and you were to take this child into this store, and if you were to pull up, and I know some people collect these things, like what I call old world Santas. You've seen them in the stores. You can buy them. Like, they look like, you know, the Santa's wearing like this long flowing robe, and he's got little woodland creatures around. He's not the red, like the red suited Santa. I bet any child could still tell you, if you were to say, who is that? They would still probably be able to tell you that's Santa Claus. I mean, granted, they would probably know, the red suited Santa better, but that doesn't make those other Santas non-Santas. But I think you're absolutely right that usually, if I were to say, draw a picture of Santa, and you start, you know, doing the red, that's branding. That's exactly what that's Coca-Cola. That's branding. But there's so many different images of Santa that I don't think, that I'm just not, I'm not comfortable saying that Santa is some sort of product of Coca-Cola. Certainly the red suited Santa is, but there's so many other images of Santa beyond that are somehow connected to, I would say, more, you know, older traditions. And the more you start tracing them back, the more they start looking like, you know, Saint Nicholas.
Absolutely. Hey, can you give me 1 second?
Sure.
I just got to go grab something, okay?
Absolutely.
you're certainly right in stating that blaming it all or stating that all of this lies on the idea of Coca-Cola creating it is incorrect. But what a lot of people incorrectly do when it comes to capitalism as a whole is blame marketers for what people want.
Right.
So there's of course a give and take. It's not just demand and supply. It's supply and demand. There's actually there's kind of a back and forth. No one knew they wanted an iPhone until they had the iPhone.
Absolutely. Right?
They had to be given it first in order for that to occur. Yep. So exploiting that aspect isn't necessarily incorrect because it's up to you individual choice as to what you want to do with it. For me personally, and now I know you went from Canada back to your hometown for Christmas.
Yeah.
I'm going back to, I don't like San Antonio, but I'm going back because I have my family and I like them. You know what I mean? You don't move to all across the country and never move back home because you like home. But
that's true.
I love my family and I think they're tremendous, and we're going to celebrate it by all eating good food and everything else.
Nice.
And it's this ritual. And I don't think it's the worst of rituals overall.
Not only is it, Carlos, the worst of rituals, I would say it's one of the best. And I would say we spoke a little bit about this at the last podcast. I think it's desperately necessary. I think what often the world lacks, I sound like such a, oh my God, a true believer, and I'm not, but I think why people feel so lost and so disconnected is because they're lacking those, I'll just call them rituals, to sort of bond with family, to bond with community. And so Christmas, whatever you want to call it, whether you see it as religious or secular, is an avenue, a matrix for which we can engage in this sort of very important behavior.
Yeah, and a ritual is going to occur whether you're secular or not. Burning Man is a very religious celebration. It's one of the most beautiful ones that exists. It's too bad that it's just too big now, where it's just too much of a hassle for me to go again.
Right.
But I mean, you burn an effigy after the entire thing is done, and many people actually, you know, some of them, their actual kids died, so they put their kids' clothing on an effigy when it burns.
Wow.
And there's an absolute beauty in that.
Wow.
And if you want to go a little bit lighter, I mean, CrossFit is secular church.
Yeah.
It's a form of community and going through something tough. I mean, you have these rituals which exist all over the world. And as long as you don't undermine critical thinking completely due to these rituals,
it
can't be the worst thing possible. I'm going to go eat some food with my parents. I got my, mom a nice gift. She's not listening right now. I doubt she listens to the podcast. that's not the worst thing, honestly, some of the things are coming to my mouth on here. But, it can be a really positive experience.
Right.
And I just want to tell people, and honestly, you guys don't need to hear from me, but if you're an atheist, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with the celebration. I think it can be a beautiful thing. Christmas sweaters, all that, scarves, cold weather. Everyone looks great in winter wear.
Yeah.
It's just true.
But I would see, Carlos, I would push it. I'm going to push it a little further in saying that I would say even for an atheist to embrace some of the religious aspects of the holiday, I think can be a really powerful thing as well. You know what I mean? Some of the more religious, like, I'm a huge part of my Christmas celebrating is centers around music. And so for me, some of the, like, this, what I'm calling sacred music around Christmas is really important for me. And I think is very, very powerful, as opposed to hearing one more rendition of, George Michael's Last Christmas. You know what I mean? Or Mariah Carey's, All I Want for Christmas.
Oh my God, I hate that song so much.
But that's what I mean.
All I want from Christmas is you.
Compare that to Old Holy Night. No, seriously.
Yeah.
Compare, like, there's such beauty and such powerful, like, sentiment behind some of the sacred music that I think atheists would miss out if they just poo-poo it or dismiss it because it's religious.
Yeah, that
again, not buying into the spiritualism or not buying into the supernaturalism of the religious aspects, but some of the true, beautiful, sort of humane, you know, foundations of that. In the same way that we were just talking about A Christmas Carol, like, I don't have to believe that ghosts come to visit people to believe that when I reflect on, you know, my past, or I reflect on my present, or I spend time reflecting on what my future might be, that those are good exercises for me to come to realize, you know, that at someday I'm going to die, and what kind of person have I been to my fellow human beings. I think that's, you know, I can get that from A Christmas Carol without having to believe in ghosts that come visit people.
If anything, that's one of the most positive journal experiences you could possibly have, which is talking to your past self. I mean, you don't even need to make much of a stretch to talk about ghosts and talking about what you've done in the past.
Oh, my God, absolutely.
That's one of the same. And that inner dialogue that we have about who we are and what we've become as a result of the past and how that can change us in the future is obviously there.
Right. And I think that it's so beautifully illustrated in that story. I mean, that scene where Scrooge is talking to Marley, and Marley is explaining what happens to the ghosts and why they're so sad. And he shows Scrooge in that one chapter, he shows Scrooge this image when he looks out his window and he sees a fellow ghost just mourning because he wants to help this street person in need. And during his lifetime, he never did that. And now that chance is passed, and he will never, ever be able to help that person in need again. And I think that is that kind of idea that by looking at our past, we regret some of these things that we may have done. And so we resolve to not do that, to sort of like go, oh my God, like, oh, I was such a dick and I don't want to be that person. And I think that's the power in the story that has nothing to do with the whole supernaturalism of the story. And I would apply that to the Gospels, to the infancy narratives, to the Christmas story as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the difference between stewing in your depression in the past and self-actualization.
You got it.
Something happened in the past and it hurt me and it hurt other people in the way that I was acting in an authentic manner. The self-actualization comes from, okay, well then how can I use that knowledge that I gained from that in order to make myself a better person in the future, which is a consistent battle that I've had throughout my entire life. I mean, I've been talking publicly about doing things like therapy, which has been tremendously helpful. And the particular type of therapy I do is called EMDR therapy. I got to have a specialist on to actually talk about this at some point, because I think it can be really helpful for a lot of people. But what it's about is forcing your brain to signal things that happened when you were younger in order to change things in the future, and literally rewiring your brain in doing that. And it's been the most important thing that I think I've ever done as far as positively impacting my life. But all it's really doing is talking to yourself in your own mind, because all those problems start in your head. You know, whether the story that we tell ourselves is the truth or falsehood, it actually doesn't matter, right? Whether a particular occurrence happened or not. I mean, of course, historically and in court, yes.
Right, yes.
Those matter.
Yes.
But your conversation with Barbara 10 years ago, you know, that doesn't matter exactly what the words were in that particular case. It's how we then interpret it and what it tells us about ourselves afterwards.
You got it.
Yeah. So these religious myths, and this is why I've been – I think the last like 3 or 4 episodes, all I've been doing is like, how do the religious myths and rituals, how do they help us who have, you know, come to the conclusion through various means that to acknowledge that we live in a, you know, godless universe filled with chaos. Well, a lot of other people came to that conclusion too, but there's different ways of being able to handle that. And I think there's a kind of beauty that can happen, obviously, through a strong familial connection. And to make the best of it, of what you can in this short period of time that we have on this convertible rock.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's you said it beautifully. And I think that's the whole, I think that is at the core of most religious messages. I think that is the, I shouldn't say most. Let me rephrase that. I want to be more careful with my language. That's at the core of a lot of religious traditions. That's certainly at the core of most Christmas celebrations, the core of certainly, you know, Dickens, it's the core of the native infancy narratives. Yeah, you said it perfectly.
Yeah, and well, thank you, Joe. I think we hit a lot there in the hour. Everything from awesome. You know, early Christmas celebrations to going to therapy, and wrap it up with a nice, like, our own little Christmas Charlie Brown speech at the end.
Yeah, there you go.
Which I'm going to throw in the middle of there.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Got to put it in there. So, hey, what I want to start doing is I want at the end of these, when I have someone on, what are some books right now that you'd recommend, whether it has to do with this topic or not? Just something that has moved you recently.
Okay, so this sounds really cheesy and lame, but I really, since you brought it up, I'm gonna say it. I honestly, every year at this time, I read unabridged. Don't get the abridged edition of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Seriously, like, I read it every year, and it's phenomenal. It's just such a great book. So in terms of like novelish, I would recommend that. In terms of religion, I would recommend, what did I read recently? Again, I had read it once, but in preparing for this interview, I reread it. His stuff is a little more conservative for my tastes, but Raymond Brown, The Birth of the Messiah. I mean, it's huge. It's a huge, huge volume. But even if you just take it in little chunks, again, he's passed away now, but he's a Catholic priest. He was a Catholic priest. So he's obviously going to take a more apologetic tone to it, but he was a solid scholar. So he'd be the first one to say, we're not dealing in history here. So he's no way a fundamentalist. But Raymond Brown's The Birth of the Messiah is quite good.
Thank you very much, Joe, for being on the show.
Thank you, Carlos.
Folks, you can find everything at thinkaboutnow.com. You can also join the Think About Now Facebook, well, besides the page, which isn't all that interesting, honestly. I just kind of post things on occasion. The group is where it's at. People are arguing about, you know, Donald Trump and the nature of Islam, and talking about Jordan Peterson, who's become my new favorite human being on earth. Listen to the Jordan B. Peterson podcast. He's fascinating. And getting really interesting dialogue in there. So get on there. Talk to the people who listen to the show, because it's a really interesting conversation, and I'm glad that I even got to host this to put all these people together. All righty, Joe. Thank you. You have a good day.
Thanks, Carlos. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. That was fun.
That was great.